that's just kind of how they happen. Because it was my son, I'm painting my son a lot, and everything has greater meaning somehow without me having to do much when it's my son. It just feels meaningful. So yeah, that's how they evolve. And so I hopefully that image reveals some of that evolution. I want students, but people, painters generally, but students, of course, to just feel like they can dump their ideas into a painting. And if your skills develop enough, you can like solve these messes that you make for yourself, and paintings become pretty interesting. It's again, it's an IU idea to me. It's a reverse idea from having a concept and then illustrating it, like having a plan. I wouldn't call it a concept, having a plan and then going about it, executing it. I think that's what people often default to because it's cleaner somehow. But there's this other way where you just follow impulses and make a mess and then clean it up. And I prefer that way.
Welcome to the Studio Break Podcast. I'm your host, David Linaway. For today's 310th episode, I'm excited to be joined by painter Neil Callender, who is an artist that lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where he is a professor at the University of Arkansas and co-director of the Studio Art program there. His work was selected by Jason Franz of Manifest in Cincinnati for a solo exhibition as part of our 2022 Pro Competition. His solo exhibition, Happy to Wait, opens here at Studio Break Gallery October 5th from 5 to 8 p.m., and that show runs through November 2nd. So please come on out and see the exhibition. Of course, we'll be talking all about the work in the show coming up and the various ways and strategies that he uses to make these really rich and densely layered paintings. Once again, you can go to his website, neilcallender.com, and be sure to follow him on Instagram. That's neil_callender. It is that time of year where we're accepting applications for our 2024 Pro Competition. Our juror this year is Mark Mitchell, the curator and director of exhibitions at the University of Arkansas. Super awesome and talented individual who'll be selecting five artists to appear on an upcoming episode of Studio Break and have a feature on the website there. He'll be selecting two sets of artists, so two-person shows, putting those together, as well as one artist for a solo exhibition right here at Studio Break Gallery in West Chicago. If you'd like to apply, head on over to studiobreak.com, look under the competition tab. You can also find that conveniently in our link tree on Instagram. Applications are really easy. You submit a small fee, you send an email with all your information, and you are done. So once again, get those apps in. Deadline is October 15th. Do you know there's some new listeners at Studio Break? I hope that you check out some of the great episodes that you miss. You can go to studiobreak.com, listen to those episodes right there on the default player. Each of those episodes have images of the artist's work, links to their websites, and of course, you can listen all about their studio practice. You can also go to Spotify or Apple and subscribe to the podcast. It's always a great studio companion, something to listen to while you're working away in the studio. If you want to go ahead, give us a follow on social media. You can find our Facebook page, so please like it. You can find us on Twitter X at Studio Break and on Instagram. That's the best way to stay in touch with Studio Break. It's at studio_break. And with announcements wrapped, let's dive right into this episode with Neil Callender. Stay tuned. Welcome to Studio Break. Neil Callender, how are you doing this morning?
I am doing great. So glad to be here and talking to you, David.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking all about your work and, of course, the upcoming exhibition, Happy to Wait, which will be here at Studio Break Gallery in West Chicago, October 5th through November 2nd. And that opening is from 5 to 8. We were just talking about how we're going to blow it out and make it super fun. So I hope that you can join us. But excited to have you on and to talk all about your stuff. So thanks for doing this.
Well, I'm super happy to be here and talk to you and have the show. I've been listening to the podcast for a while. A lot of people, students that I've had and people that I know, and they've all participated. And you, I think, have done an interesting thing. You've been doing this for years, and if you start digging through the back catalog of interviews, it's like a very unique archive that you've created of painters and artists, mostly around the middle of the country. And is there another one quite like it? I don't think so. It's great.
Well,
It's a great resource.
I appreciate that. Well, again, we're going to dive into backgrounds and stuff. It's funny because I looked up some of the places that you've been, and Indiana University kind of pops into my mind because there's been some artists and observational painters that I've certainly spoken with from there. But where are you from? Are you a Midwesterner then? Or.
Yeah, sort of near south, I think, is the closest thing. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, which
Okay.
is southern but not quite deep south. And that's a great town. I'm really proud of my hometown. It's got an interesting history. It really knows itself as a town. It's horse racing and bourbon and basketball and Muhammad Ali,
Sure.
Jennifer Lawrence. It's a beautiful place with a lot of history and a clear identity. Good music too. A lot of great music comes out of Louisville.
Then obviously too, right now you're currently in Fayetteville, Arkansas, as a professor there at the University of Arkansas. So,
That's
we'll
right.
probably talk a little bit about that. But the first thing that I just think of is I don't know why I imagine you as a little kid bringing home like every book from the library on like every artist or something. That could be way off basis, but I don't know. What kind of things were you interested in when you were younger? Was art something that was on the radar really early on?
Definitely was making maybe more than art. I definitely wasn't a scholar as a little kid. I was pretty active and a maker. It was going outside and making forts in the woods and friendship bracelets, going to camp, making drawings. I was a Boy Scout as a kid, Cub Scout, then a Boy Scout. So a lot of hiking and camping and tying knots and building fires. Went to summer camp every summer, church camp, Boy Scout camp, both of them every summer. A lot of just of making. And then it was pretty seamless. I mean, from making sandcastles and picking up rocks and stacking them to being a drawer and making paintings. It seemed seamless to me. It seems like all the same stuff.
And were your folks like super supportive of it? They just saw that you were, built this way and encouraging you to check it out and to take classes and whatnot.
Yeah, they were supportive. They have good folks. Well, they're not artists. My mom's a school teacher, and my dad is a small business owner in leasing. And I had a comfortable childhood, and they were supportive, and I took classes at the Louisville Water Tower. That's where they offered some, classes for kids, and took art in school and went to a high school that was an arts, public arts magnet, DuPont Manual. Shout out to Miss Neumeyer and Miss Sidebottom, the good high school art teachers that encouraged me. But yeah, it just they didn't discourage me, that's for sure. I
Sure.
think they didn't fully trust, as any parent would, that your artsy kid is gonna be successful and be able to support themselves in life. But I know, won them over eventually. They're gonna try to come to the show
Oh, sweet,
in
sweet.
October. Come up from Louisville. They like to do what they can.
Awesome, awesome. And I guess, thinking about that then, was the trajectory then going to college, like I'm gonna study fine art, or was there, like myself, I think I was art education at first or something. Like, yeah, that's the smart path. And I'll be honest now, as a teacher, probably could have helped to have at least a minor in that to know how to properly write lesson plans. But was it always just studio art?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my mind, in my heart, it was. There was flirtations with graphic design, but that didn't last very long. I went to school looking for arts program. It was pretty much just painting, actually, and drawing. I mean, I did it all as students do, but painting and drawing really had me pretty early, and ended up at Indiana University. Was thinking about MICA for a minute there, and Boston University, and I think I can't tell you why I chose IU. My sister had gone there. I felt so. I mean, who knows what would have been if I would have gone to Boston? That's a great school, but IU was so great, and I did not know what I was getting into. It fit me like a glove, and I had a great experience there.
So you were the student who you could just bully into fixing every type of issue with like a measured drawing, I'm assuming, in those early classes where it's super tedious and you're trying to learn how to work from observation. I'm assuming you're, like a fish in water, if you will.
Oh, absolutely. I just felt like I was on fire. I'm trying to picture myself and my students now. Like, what does 18-year-old Neil feel like in the classroom if I was his professor? And I think I was just very enthusiastic. Worked in a studio all the time, slept in the studio on the floor, curled up in the still life drapery, was all pimply because my hands were at oil paint and charcoal, and I was rubbing them on my face and drinking coffee and just couldn't get enough of it. I really wanted to prove myself. I felt like I knew I had a certain ability, but I just didn't know how far it went. And that even though it came kind of easily, or at least it felt like it came easier to me than some people, it also felt like there were such great depth there in studying painting and drawing. And I just didn't know how far it could go. Like it was hard. It was still really, really hard. And so at moments, I would feel like exultation and feeling like I made the best still life drawing in the drawing one class. And then immediately realizing that it was still crap. It could still be so much better.
Sure.
I was just motivated to work hard.
And did you have a lot of like experience previously, like going to, museums or like s experiencing art, outside of, maybe some of those classes that you were taking? 'Cause, for myself, I mean, it's weird. I don't remember going to art museums and stuff like that when I was young. Certainly lots of museums, but.
I don't remember it either. I don't think I went to any art museums. Maybe in high school in Chicago, I went to the Art Institute once, maybe. But I don't have a clear memory of that. Again, it wasn't really I wasn't really a scholar. I mean, people would show me work or I would find paintings that I liked, but it just never occurred to me to look that person up, to go deeper when I was younger. And it really wasn't until I remember being in Barnes and Noble. I was probably 16, and I went to the art section, and there was a book by Egon Schiele, or on Egon Schiele, and I thought it was so great, and I stuffed it in my pants and stole it because I just had to have it, and I thought like, oh, I have discovered Egon Schiele. No one knows who this is. I didn't realize that, of course, if he's in Barnes and Noble, a lot of people know
Right.
what it is, but no one had told me about Egon Schiele, so I felt like I discovered him. And that was really a significant, that was like the first painter that I really felt like I did a little research on and started to understand what they were about.
Well, and to kind of think about that experience at IU, like, I don't know, what kind of things were you kind of drawn to? Because it, thinking about your current work, I would imagine there are a lot of the same things, certainly like the figure, the still life, working from observation. I don't know, what types of things were you really kind of drawn to, especially, as we kind of think about that progression. I'm sure, like you were talking about, when you pull off that still life drawing, you're like, how did this happen? But I'm especially thinking about like where the work went, even in that kind of period of time.
Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack, actually. IU was great for me. And I'm actually putting together a presentation right now for a conference, an academic conference, about the panel is on our influences, artist influences, and how information is transferred from one generation to the next and gets digested. And so my presentation is going to be on Indiana University's painting program, its ethos and axioms. And I've been talking to my former classmates and professors and trying to put a finger on that. There was an observational thread, largely Tim Kennedy and Eve Mansour, who just retired from IU, brought a lot of that. And I really appreciated that. There was something about working from observation that was kind of an antidote to overthinking or being too conceptually driven. The concept is largely you are working from observation. The world is interesting. That's the concept. So you don't have to necessarily make too convoluted of an idea for a painting if you're working observationally. So that was an important part of it. But and then relatedly, but maybe a broader idea that happened at IU was this idea what that I'm calling that facture is like fossil. So it's the facture of a painting, how it's made, the marks, the layers, the construction. That is information. That's more than information, actually. It's like the meaning of the painting. And in the studio, if you're working on a painting for a long time, painters solve visual problems in a sort of weird poetic way. You're solving visual problems. And it's like poetry. It's like crafting a poem. And that information, instead of language, is captured in the marks and the surface. And that is exuding a lot of meaning. It's like the emotion and the mood, and it tells you about time, and it tells you about, the painter's body and how it moves, and all these little decisions really add up. And if you are thoughtful and maybe need a little knowledge about painting, you can look at a painting and start to unravel that information and make sense of the material narrative of the painting, how it was made. And so it wasn't ever said quite like that that I remember, but that was the ethos of the place of IU. I don't remember really ever talking about concept. We were talking about more about how paintings are made. And then when they're made, what do they do to us? As an audience, as a viewer, this painting feels dark and sinister. This one is silly. This one has both of those qualities. Like to really just talk about them that way was deeply influential to me. And I think that I don't know, I can't separate myself from that experience because it's hard to imagine me today as an artist feeling differently. It's hard to imagine a conceptual artist. That's me.
And I guess what was that experience like when you took it to Rutgers? Because, I think I've said it about a billion times, during these interviews, but it could be a pretty interesting situation. You might have a old timer or somebody that's just like, "What is all this? You got to throw this out," or some new person that's so well read that it's like, "What, what's the meaning, But was it something then in the start of that experience where you feel like you could find a way to kind of carry that forward and kind of develop it a little further, or were you really challenged?
Yeah, I was looking for the sweet spot between those things. I wanted a program. I knew that IU was giving me a lot, but what I felt like I needed was to see a lot more contemporary art in person in grad school. So I was targeting schools on the East Coast, close to New York City. And Rutgers was a great one because there were painters there. And so even though the program was interdisciplinary, I had some sense that I wasn't going to try to be talked out of painting. And I knew myself enough to know that if someone did try to talk me out of painting, I'd reject it. And that would be bad. That could cause some bad experience in grad school. So it really did that well for me. I definitely felt a little bit of the odd one. I didn't know really, I knew very few artists past Warhol coming into graduate school, but I voraciously consumed a lot in grad school and figured a lot of it out. But no one really tried to talk me out of it. I mean, I got pushed. Emma Amos was a mentor in grad school, and she came into the studio, and I was painting these bed paintings, these big beds, empty beds. And she came in and said that she thought she heard footsteps coming from behind the beds, and that I should put speakers and make an installation with these bed paintings and some sounds. This was my first semester in graduate school. And it's Emma Amos. Like, I was deeply reverential to her. I thought she's so great. I really loved her, and I loved her work. And so when she said something like that, my like Southern sensibilities were, oh my gosh, maybe I'm supposed to do this. But then a little part of me, that a little bit of an obstinate, person was thinking, I'm never going to do this. So I told her Oh, I'm never gonna do that. I'm sorry. Like, and she looked at me. This is like a one-on-one studio visit, and just started to laugh. And then we had a great relationship afterward. She felt like she understood where I was coming from, and we had were pretty productive conversations after that. Yeah, that's all to say, I got a lot out of graduate school, and actually, it felt like I got a lot exactly what I wanted to get out of it, which was a much more contemporary knowledge base about painting and contemporary art and experiences in the city.
Yeah, and one thing that I would highlight that we haven't mentioned too, you can go to neilcalendar.com. I'm literally looking at some of these bed paintings. So there's a big archive of images, and even just looking at some of those works, like there's one Box Springs that I'm checking out where there's a lot of play with the composition, right? Or even just the relationship between the structure that holds the bed up. But other thing that I'm struck by, some massive paintings and some small paintings. So you're not afraid to kind of go big and small, which is not unlike the work that you'll be showing here. But I don't know, was there anything that kind of maybe suggested ways that you would look differently in like your thesis exhibition or how that had evolved from your undergraduate? Like maybe tell us a little bit about the work that was coming at the end there, like what you were most interested in, and then we can kind of carry forward from there.
First, to your point, yes, I put it all on the website. Why do people edit their work out? I want to see archives of painters' work on their website. So I have stuff from way back when, and it's all there. And I think that the whole trajectory is interesting for people to look at. And some of that work is a little bit embarrassing, but I put it up there anyway. I leave it there. Your question though, the beds, it felt to me like one of my first semi-mature moves in painting, which was to eliminate the figure for a while. Looking at my undergraduate paintings, they felt hot, like emotionally hot and kind of hard to look at. There's a lot of angsty kind of Egon Schiele-esque figures, and there's the themes of them I liked, but they were a strain to look at. So I cut the figure out and thought about the beds as kind of like stand-ins for a figure. I mean, the body does go on the bed. They're designed for bodies. And but it was more my sweet spot, which is probably still life painting, because it allows for a great amount of compositional fine-tuning and adjusting this and that infinitely. If the still life is in front of you, I can make adjustments until I refine it so that it starts to feel just right. And in doing that, they quieted down a little bit, the paintings. They felt a little bit more approachable and a little bit more ambiguous and cooled off. And I really liked that. From those beds, I looked around for other subject matter that was a kind of a vessel imbued with kind of human intimacy, and became beds and old televisions. So these TVs that, had been stared at for countless hours. I should say TVs from like the 70s, which were excellently designed. Those TVs are so handsome, Zenith, and with the wood framing and the nice knobs and everything. But they've been stared at for decades, and fondled. You had to touch them. And they put people to sleep, and they educated and babysat children, and they were your friend. So they felt like they had a lot of human intimacy imbued into them. And then I decided to paint them turned on to static as a way to charge them a little bit more, that they would feel like they're electric, they have electricity. But there wasn't like an image on the screen. It had the potential of you could adjust the rabbit ears, and all of a sudden, you would tune to PBS and Oscar the Grouch, or you would tune, it would be the news. It was like that potential was there. It was really then, in my mind, offering more of an opening to the viewer, more of an experience, as opposed to trying to communicate something specific or tell something specific to the viewer. But that just started to feel less and less like my job. I think that was the maturing that happened in graduate school.
Well, and something that strikes me, and I think you were talking a little bit about this relative to like the compositions, you know, that's one of the things that I think kind of create a little bit of tension or maybe a variety in the work is like, especially even now, you kind of will just go, you know, you might have something that looks one way or very straight on, and then something that is, you know, really closed up. And even with the TV ones, you know, there's ones that might have like an awkward cropping so that it, you know, that it's a screen, but you kind of have to put it together, or there's one with like a subtle reflection on it, you know. And again, it's interesting to kind of think about how that evolves. So what happened after this? I mean, were you immediately into your current position? You know, you graduate, and then the next semester you're a tenured professor. Or was there a lot in between, you know, waiting, working in art stores or something? I don't know.
Yeah, there was a lot in between, of course. I mean, one thing I didn't expect to get out of grad school, that grad school delivered to me was a wife. My wife, Adrienne, was in my cohort in at Rutgers. And then I went to Skowhegan the mid-summer in graduate school and returned, and we got pregnant. And so I wasn't expecting that to happen for sure. But I really wanted to stay in New York for a while. My wife's from New York City, so she was a native and very comfortable there. But I wanted to stretch. That was my big plan, you know, before the whole kid marriage and kid thing. I hustled and really almost begged to get a job at Jeff Koons' studio. I knew one person that worked there, and I needed a way to support, you know, a young family, and just my skills were in painting, so we moved to the Bronx, and I painted Jeff's paintings for about a year. Met great people, but made very few of my own paintings, basically none. Having a little baby and working all the time in Queens' studio. So when my son Finn started to walk around, and we started to think about school, and think about what money you need to make it happen in New York City, we left. And I got my first sort of adjunct teaching job at University of Louisville. So we went back to my hometown where my folks were, and you know, were really poor for a while. I worked teaching as many classes as I could at the University of Louisville, Indiana University Southeast campus. My wife also was adjuncting. I worked at a liquor store, Old Town Liquor, picking up hours. I worked at a farmer's market selling really good raw milk cheese, Kenny's Farmhouse cheese, on Saturdays to try to make ends meet. And my studio is in the basement of this little house that we rented, and then eventually were able to buy just a dirty basement full of mice and low ceilings and dirt floor. And but I actually made some good paintings in there. Finally, I figured out. So back to the art part. But my life had dramatically changed, and the idea that it took a while to grab onto in the studio was maybe more is more. This was my big idea, that if the more I could put into the painting, maybe that made the painting better. So the still lives, where they were very minimalist, just a single bed or a TV, started to accumulate lots of stuff, which reflected my life. I had a kid and a dog and a wife and a house and, you know, three jobs. So I would dip into the studio and, you know, paint a Miller High Life bottle, and then I'd come back and paint a paperback book, all in the same painting. And these paintings just started to accumulate lots of stuff, domesticky kind of stuff, basement stuff. Things that gather in a basement, you know, that don't always make perfect sense together. The old stuff, it's man cave, it's, you know, it's you know, nostalgic stuff that you're is in storage or whatever, VHS tapes. And so yeah, those were the first paintings, and I really liked those paintings. They really, I figured something out there. I was able to then get a bigger studio, And I pushed that idea to the extreme, and I have these really densely populated paintings, still life paintings, in which sort of the, maybe the next layer of idea there was creating an alter ego, this guy Dusty, this character Dusty, which actually my young son named. I asked him for a title, and he said, "What's a title?" And I said, "It's like a name, but for a painting." And he said, "How about Dusty?" And I don't know where that came from, but it seemed perfect for a dusty basement, dusty as an like American figure. I felt more free to make them less about myself and more about sort of populating Dusty's world. And that the still lifes felt less deranged and more like pulled from Dusty's real world. And that was a liberating thing. And that was several years in Louisville making those paintings.
Well, and it's funny because it makes me feel actually like my studio right now. You know, these are all, I think, what, like Dusty's workspace and, you know, adjacent titles to that. So, you know, you're just seeing piles of stuff. And it's interesting the kind of bits that you find, you know, it could be like an old show card or something, an old movie next to an empty can or.
The idea there of that they didn't have to add up to a clear singular narrative. That if paintings were to reflect life in some way, even if it wasn't my life, it was this imaginary character, Dusty. That's how still life happens. It's you put one pile of shit next to another pile of shit, and they get mixed up in the domestic space, and all kinds of meanings can be extracted by putting one thing next to another thing. Yeah, at the time I was looking at a lot of like Dutch still life painting. I mean, those intensely composed, populated, full of life, golden era of Dutch still life were super important to me at that time.
And I guess, you know, one thing that we haven't talked too much about then is this stuff that's coming out of just that experience of being there, you know, just kind of coming back to the studio and being in that environment. Or, you know, I say that because we're in a time where, you know, there's folks that are working really removed from like photographs or, you know, digitally editing, you know, their photographs or journaling and working in a sketchbook and composing, you know, in so many different ways. But are you somebody that kind of wants to just return to that experience and find something, or are you doing a lot to compose these from like drawings and notes and studies and stuff like that?
Yeah, mostly just diving in. I mean, I found the best way for me to work was to dive in. Well, I have lots of little strategies. I could one strategy for these still lifes was that I would gather a bunch of stuff and set them up in a way that I thought worked, and then I would take it all down and set it back up really fast. So without thinking too much, I would just slam all the objects together. And there's something about that that made it feel more natural than if I was to carefully set it up. And then I dive right into the painting and start doing sketches and value studies and things mid-painting, like as a way to solve the problems that I've created for myself. Not too much pre-planning, but figuring it out along the way, which might include photographing to sort of help with composition. And then the paintings just evolve, like that Dusty's workspace has a plate with like the leftover, pie filling of cherry pie on it. That's because I was sitting down there looking at the still life in the painting, wondering what to do, eating my cherry pie in the basement. And then I thought, well, I just put this dirty plate in there. And that happened. And so that it made the painting then feel fresh again. Like it's happening right now, today. I've done something, ate something, and put it in there. So that kind of thing happened a lot.
Well, and it looks like kind of changing the atmosphere, you know, or the environment too. Like there's like a glow to some of these, you know, and obviously there's an interesting color, but even in that one, there's kind of like this nice kind of red glow coming from the background, and you know, you kind of see that throughout. Like that could be like fluorescence or something. I don't know, maybe talk a little about the relationship of that to like light and color, because obviously that seems really important too, because it's not washed out fluorescent, you know, light necessarily that we're looking at with these.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, yeah, you were saying that there are big paintings and there are small paintings. I feel like I want to be good at all the types of paintings, which is a big thing. So Yes, small and big. And then yes, you look at the group of paintings that maybe you just made and you think, okay, how could these be better? And I looked at my brown basement-y still life paintings and I thought, oh, well, what about color, Neil? Maybe you should be better at that since you're a painter. So the way that I was able to get it in there, at least initially, was to change the lighting. I did have this pink kind of grow light because I was also gardening in the backyard in our little backyard in Louisville, Kentucky, and I would sprout the seedlings, and so this pink light, I was like, oh, I don't want to put in false objects, colorful objects just to have color. So I'm going to swap out my halogen bulb for this grow light. It's pink. And then I had this other magnifying light, this kind of greenish fluorescent thing. It made a whole pink green relationship, which is really my favorite color combination. And so by separating the painting into like things that are in this greenish kind of light and things that are in this pinkish kind of light, and in a way that made it feel still felt kind of natural. There was old technology and basement-y kind of stuff. The color just started to really improve and became much more of a force in the work, carrying meaning, just making much richer type of surfaces with lots more of a nuance of color. Hopefully also an illusion of light, it starts to convey an atmosphere. I mean, that's something I've been working on now for years, is to packet the difference between a sort of a rendering of what light does versus a painting that really starts to emanate its own light. Someone told me that long ago, and I did not understand. And I finally am starting to understand the important distinction between those things. So, so color started to be a big thing. And then, I'm still figuring that out and working with that. But I'm understanding that my color sensibility tends to be prismatic. And I explain that to students by thinking, so if you're working in black and white, like in charcoal, your professor might ask you, what is the darkest moment that you see in the still life? And let's make that black. And what is the lightest thing that you see? And let's make that as light and white as we can. And then you're supposed to use all the range of grays in between. I'm thinking classic drawing one, still life with the directional light source, chiaroscuro thing. Well, it occurred to me, you could do the same thing with color. Regardless of the scene, you could look at it and say, what is the purpliest thing? What is the greenest thing? What is the darkest greenest thing? And start to identify these moments and find them like prismatically through color mixing. Even if the darkest greenest thing isn't really an intense green, it's still going to be the greenest thing in relationship to the other colors in the painting. So thinking that way, turns out that many of the paintings now feel like rainbows. Maybe not, hopefully not cliche rainbows, but the whole prism is happening in them.
I'm taking a quick coffee break to remind you to head on over to Cedar Break if you're enjoying this podcast. There's a lot of episodes that you might have missed out on, over 300 episodes each with images of the artist's work, links to their websites. You can, of course, listen right there on cedarbreak.com or subscribe in Spotify or Apple. That way you've always got something to listen to while you're working away in the studio, and it makes a great studio companion. While you're there, please take a second to subscribe to our periodic newsletter that just goes out to remind you about opportunities like our 2024 Cedar Break Pro Competition, juried by Mark Mitchell, deadline October 15th, or new podcasts as well as exhibitions coming up here at Cedar Break Gallery. And if you're enjoying the content, please be sure to follow us in social media, like our Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter X at Cedar Break, but the best way is on Instagram at studio_break. And now let's get right back into this interview with Neil Callender. Maybe talk a little bit too about some of the other bodies of work, because obviously there's, different folders for, heads that are kind of more figurative. Maybe kind of like portraits or, related to the figure. I'm sure people that versus like some of the other bodies, like the outside is, maybe pretty self-explanatory in terms of working from, I'm assuming, life and whatnot. But how does all these things kind of fit together to, maybe where you're at now. I feel like there's so much to cover, but
Yeah.
we can't have a 19-hour podcast because we'd lose everybody.
So yeah, like I said, I've tried to do all things painting. I want to do it all well. So landscape, still life, portraiture, abstraction. I've been working across all of that. I definitely feel fractured at sometimes. I or schizophrenic. Sometimes I don't feel like it congeals. But then when enough work gets made and you start to see it, and there is this, I think, a sensibility that's starting to hold the work together. My last kind of solo show was called Companion Paintings, and I hung the work in suites where the color really held different genres of work, from landscape to abstraction to portraiture, kind of held them together. They were related because of a sensibility of a color palette. I think there's also a sensibility of refinement and density that comes across in the work. Like I don't crop often. I try to pack out the rectangle or the circle, the tondo, full of information and push on the edges and sort of situate the color shapes in there so they're pretty densely orchestrated. That usually takes a lot of refinement, so layers of adjustments, repainting and tweaking, and so the there's that sensibility of composition, and then also as a result, the surfaces get pretty worked. And I think that ties the work together. But it's hard to define. I mean, I try to put into words this sensibility or this aesthetic. It's a really weird thing, David. It's like a self-portrait in a way. Even if it's, not my image, I start to see all this work and I'm like, that's freaking me. What is that? It's not my outward self, it's my inward self sort of showing up in this whole big body of work. And it's like you can't escape it. I can think I do sometimes. I'm like, I'm really going to try something new now, but eventually it ends up being me still. I mean, I think maybe I'm not saying anything groundbreaking here, but like it freaks me out sometimes.
Well, it's an interesting approach because I start, looking at the range and it occurs to me, like even with the shows here, there's so much that goes into putting them on. In a weird way, it's kind of like I'm having a solo exhibition or a group exhibition when they're going through. And I always think about like that time afterwards, like from a big show, there's always a little bit of that reflection. And to me, it just makes me think of like the instincts that we might have to try something new or to try something unknown, And so as I'm looking around, I think that's really exciting because, like maybe to talk about something that's, a bit more current, like the self-portrait with eye shade that I've been walking past, frequently as we're getting ready for the show. Like, it's, I don't know, it's just interesting because you might move on from one experience and then I don't know how you set a painting like that up, but, there's, and maybe talk a little about that one. I don't know. Sometimes I start trying to do it and I feel like the artist can do a little bit better, but how'd that one come about? And this is from a couple of years ago.
And most of the work in the show took many years. Like, that's one thing, is the work is taking me longer and longer to resolve. So I've started just being honest about that and dating them from the point of inception to the point of resolution. So, I don't know how many years that one took, probably 3 years or something. So that's one thing. And they start, and it started, they almost all start, which is a dumb impulse. Like, oh, what I want to paint. Like that one started because I ordered these eye shades of every color from Amazon, and Amazon sent me a double order. So I had like 20 different colored visor, transparent visor eye shades. And I started doing a self-portrait demo in my painting one class with a red one. That was it, with a mask. I had a COVID mask on that had red cherries on it. So this was my genius idea: red eye, red visor, mask with cherries. They take so long, and that I just add ideas into them. They evolve. So it became a green eye shade because I was looking at Chardin. And Chardin has that great self-portrait with his eye shade that's green. And I thought, oh, great, I'll steal that. So I switched it to green. And then I had this idea where I wanted the head to be larger than life because it was a life size at first in the painting. You know, for like a year, it was life size. Then I was like, no, I like when heads are larger than life size. So I pushed it larger than life size. And then I thought, well, I really like Walter Murch. You know, Walter Tandy Murch, that still life painter. Anyway, I could tell you a lot about him. He's that interesting painter. Not super well known, but anyway, he's got terrific edges. He really wonderful edges, really blown out, soft, luminous edges. So I thought, ah, I want those too. So I started playing with the edges and pushing the edges and doing all kinds of things to the surface so I could get these lovely, soft, glowy edges, you know. And then for like the last, I don't know, 6 months, I had like, I got to refine this thing. I got to make it better. So fixing the features and working the some of the details so that that visor would really feel plasticky and transparent and be the shape just right. And yeah, that's how they evolve. I just keep adding ideas, and the ideas mean that the painting changes and I add layers too. I kind of want more people to work like that. I don't I just really, it's a dangerous idea when I real it's like a realization that the longer I worked on these paintings, the bet that the better they got. I mean, when I started to, I realized that that's a dangerous idea, like that maybe I should never finish because they got the surfaces got richer, they felt like there were more ideas embedded in them, they got more refined somehow, and they carried more meaning. I mean, I do try to eventually, thank God for the show, David, because I eventually try to resolve them.
Yeah, I believe Mark was saying you've been working, so our mutual friend.
Yeah, Mark Mitchell. Yeah,
Yeah.
he's a hard worker too. And I, it's, you know, we're both kind of studio rats. It's good to be in the studio.
Well, something that occurs to me then too is obviously then you're coming back to these too and shifting around to different works. I would imagine sometimes they take as much time as they need, you know. And I guess, you know, one thing that's really interesting to kind of think about the evolution of it, you know, and that's kind of something that we're talking a bit about, especially in kind of reworking, is the image that we chose for the promotion, which is the imagined fin, long hair and beard. You can kind of see a little bit of that progression and that shift and change over time. And I don't know, like obviously that's your son, you know, relative to like the idea, but so it's just as simple as that. Like I wonder if and just starting with that impetus or
Yeah, that's it's even more base. I mean, that painting of my son really started, and I should say I've been trying to reveal the process more because I think that's actually more, that's pretty interesting for people are interested in seeing that. I think it shows there's like a mystery there because I don't think anybody could really recreate my process, but also it's revealing and demystifies that these things don't just happen, you know, out of nothing. A former professor of mine, Hanalina Rogerberg at Rutgers, she made these animal pelt paintings of animal pelts, furry, wonderful things. And I thought that was great. And I'm like, I want to paint fur. So I started this like throwing pink paint around to make it kind of look furry-ish, pelt-like, basically just copying Hanalina, feeling like that sounds good to me. Then it became imagining, you know, instead of fur, it was hair. And then it became like, what if I'm doing these portraits of my son, so let me imagine what he would look like as an adult with long hair and a beard. And then it's like, what long hair and a beard? So then it became a little bit like looking at pop culture Jesus images to find interesting long hair and beard. And then it became, well, also the hair started to feel more like the ocean to me. So I was looking at some of my favorite Courbet paintings of waves and trying to pull some of his, you know, crashing ocean waves into the painting too. That's just kind of how they happen. because it was my son, I'm painting my son a lot, and everything has greater meaning somehow without me having to do much when it's my son. It just feels meaningful. So yeah, that's how they evolve. And so I hopefully that image reveals some of that evolution. I want students, but people, painters generally, but students, of course, to just feel like they can dump their ideas into a painting. And if your skills develop enough, you can like solve these messes that you make for yourself, and paintings become pretty interesting. It's again, it's an IU idea to me. It's a reverse idea from having a concept and then illustrating it, like having a plan. I wouldn't call it a concept, having a plan and then going about it, executing it. I think that's what people often default to because it's cleaner somehow. But there's this other way where you just follow impulses and make a mess and then clean it up. And I prefer that way.
Is there a piece in the show that you think about that as a particular interesting story, or something that again surprised you? Because it seems like you kind of dig yourself into these holes and dig yourself out of them, I guess, or climb out of them, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. That it does feel like that sometimes. Although I don't know, a lot of times I'm not trying to climb, I'm just like wallowing in the mud of the hole. They all have stories. They all have these sort of like layer upon layer of references. All the work in the shows have been, they've been around for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years in the studio. So they have all been really processed. I mean, maybe one thing I haven't really talked about yet is lately, and there is one painting that really directly references Piero della Francesca, who I really wish I could paint like there's a certain sensibility, a stillness and a quiet, like a frozenness in his paintings. They just feel so much like paintings to me, like what painting can do so well. It's like so much going on. It's very composed and very orchestrated, but they're not loud. You feel so taken care of. Like everything has so much dignity in his paintings. And he was a mathematician, so there's like a very careful geometry happening as well as the painting. And I was in Italy. I taught in Rome in 2022. So we were there for 6 weeks, 7 weeks, I guess. And we got to travel around and see a lot of paintings and a lot of Piero paintings in person, including going to Arezzo and seeing his Legends of the True Cross fresco there. So there's one painting in the show that I've never really done. I've never done a master copy ever. Somehow I avoided that in all of school. And this isn't really a master copy, but it kind of is, I guess. I took his a tent that he painted that is the panel is Constantine's dreams. And it was one of the first like nocturnes, painted this beautiful evening light. It's nighttime, but the light's coming from this angel. And I nealified it. I like painted this tent, pulling out Constantine and pulling out the bed and pulling out the post that holds up the tent and pulling out the angel and pulling out the people, and just made this empty vessel of a tent, like a void, and paid very close attention to how Piero went about the geometry of that tent. And he's so good. He's so good. And all these triangles, these lovely archy triangles that he uses to compose. And that was like the final move to solve that painting. But the painting is like, I don't know, it's probably got 500 layers of paint because it was 500 different paintings. And I don't think painting Piero's Constantine's tent on a flat surface, like on a new panel or something, would have worked. It like needed all these layers somehow. I don't know, I can't explain it. But there's like history in that painting, and that the end solution is pulled from art history, but it's also this void for the viewer to enter your imagination, your mind can enter into the space of a painting. I was a little bit proud. Rarely does it happen so cleanly that I the last idea worked out so well. And that the image that you see probably took 4 weeks, which is super fast for me
Right.
to pull off. But the painting had been around for like at least 6 years. Again, it had been so many different paintings. So I don't know. I found that painting. I feel satisfied with that one for sure. Yeah. And I feel like it's in communication with history, with Piero. That conflation of time is really, I think that's interesting to me. That's what painting can do. There is almost no distinction to be made to me between Piero and another contemporary painter. Like his work is so relevant and I know there's like a glaze of history that people have a tough time seeing beyond. Like the color is the pigments that were available to him, and there's a the fresco has deteriorated some degree, so it has that look of being very, very old. But the humanity that he has is the same thing that we're trying to have now. He did it. And so seeing something like that from 400 years, let's say 500 years ago is, I don't know, deeply comforting, and that I can try to be in conversation with it feels so meaningful to me. And that's the end.
It's awesome. I'm so glad that we're bringing you here so that you can bring all of these works for people to consider in the flesh and to kind of hopefully put an end to it. Maybe you'll be going back into these when you get them back, but hopefully you settled on some at
I
the
know
same time.
I'm afraid of that. I think by saying what I just said about that last painting, I'm like putting a stake in the ground that I won't touch it if it comes back to the studio.
Well, again, I'm hopeful that we're going to have a lot of wonderful people out to see the show. Again, it's going to be October 5th from 5 to 8 for the opening, and it'll run through November 2nd. Happy to wait. And so again, just come on out to Cedar Break Gallery and check out the show. You can meet Neil and ask him some questions about how many layers this one has. But some things to kind of think before we kind of end. I know again we're in a time where half the artists I talk to don't update their websites, but please give us the rundown of where people can check in and see some of these works in previews. Obviously, we'll be sharing them, but.
Yeah, neilcalendar.com. I've been working to keep it updated. I've been updating it recently, and I as I'm documenting work for the show, I'm putting it up. And I don't hold back. Like I said, it's all I don't think there's anything from undergrad, but a lot of things from graduate on are there. So have a look. And then at Neil underscore calendar on Instagram, I've been trying to, do my best. I feel like I don't quite understand the protocols around Instagram, but the tone I've struck on there is like professorial poet painter. And that seems to work. I don't share what I eat. I just share paintings that I make and see out there in the world and try to put a few thoughts in the caption.
Yeah, and again, harkens back to me to the artist statement a little bit in terms of talking about the importance of painting and the, meaningfulness of it, in a digital world. And I know that we're all kind of guilty of screen time, but definitely worth a follow on Instagram to break up your day. That's Neil underscore calendar on Instagram, so be sure to follow there. Yeah, super excited to do this and have you on, and excited to bring you here. So thanks again for doing this, and yeah, excited for it.
Me too, David, and anybody listening, I sure hope you can come if you can come, that you do come. It's important to sort of convene. I feel like I hole up in the studio. I mean, I have students and people I talk to, but to convene with other artists and see work in person and to have that kind of experience is super important. So, David, you're doing a super rare thing. I just love that it's like this alternative space, like a garage in the suburbs. And we're putting out the bat signal, and like everybody hopefully will come and pull up on your lawn, like you said, and eat and drink and be merry and talk about art. That sounds like the best.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks to Neil for joining me once again. His solo exhibition, Happy to Wait, opens here at Cedar Break Gallery on October 5th from 5 to 8 p.m. and runs through November 2nd. Please come on out October 5th. It's going to be a fantastic time. You can see some of these great paintings and talk to Neil. A gallery of available works from the exhibition will be on cedarbreak.com, so you can check out those as well. Be sure to follow him on Instagram at neil_calendar and check out his website at neilcalendar.com. Reminder once again that our 2024 Pro competition is now open. Our juror, Mark Mitchell, is the curator and director of exhibitions at the University of Arkansas. He'll be selecting five artists to appear on an upcoming episode of Studio Break and to be featured on the website with an image gallery and an in-depth interview about their work. He'll also be selecting two sets of artists. That's four artists, two-person exhibitions coming up at Cedar Break Gallery here in West Chicago, and one artist will receive a solo exhibition at Cedar Break Gallery. If you'd like to apply, head on over to studiobreak.com, look under the competition tab, and you find all the information. You can also find it in the link tree on Instagram at studio_break, but it's really easy. You submit a small fee, you send an email with all of your information, and you are done. Once again, deadline October 15th. Get those apps in today and help spread the word if you don't mind earning some karma points. If you enjoyed today's episode, head on over to studiobreak.com and check out some of the archived episodes that go back year by year by year. There's tons of stuff there to listen to, over 300. Each of those posts have images of the artist's artwork, links to their websites, and you can listen to the interview right there on studiobreak.com, or head on over to Spotify or Apple and subscribe there. It makes a great studio companion. If you want to rate it, that would be awesome, and you also earn some karma points as well. Music for today's episode is by Golden Shadow, which features myself, Ben Cohan, and Brett Beery. You can follow us on Instagram at Golden Shadow Band. You can check out some of Ben's work on Instagram at mbencohanstudio, and his website's linked there. You can also check out Brett Beery and listen to some of the original music coming out of Central Illinois through his label, Typical Stereo Records, which is also linked there at Brett Beery on Instagram and at Typical Stereo Records on Bandcamp. You might also like to check out our EP that came out a while back, Lawn Dreams, that's also linked in the link tree. And of course, if you're interested in what I do, you can check out my work in the same website, davidlinaway.com. It's all merged there. Be sure to follow everywhere at David Linaway, but the Instagram is the best place to get a hold of me. And as always, be sure to follow all things Studio Break. You can like our Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter X at Studio Break. But the best way to say, hey, hello, I love this episode is on Instagram at studio_break. Please let know, Neil, that you enjoyed this podcast. And of course, big shout out to the University of Arkansas family. As always, hope you are crushing it in your studio, having an excellent time, productive time. We'll talk to you real soon.